This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. September 15th marks the start of National Hispanic Heritage Month. Shared between 2 months, it celebrates the contributions of Hispanic Americans. Debbie Lee DiStefano, a professor of Spanish in the Department of Modern Languages, Anthropology, and Geography at Southeast Missouri State University, tells us more about it and what activities you can look forward to in Cape Girardeau. For those who aren't aware of Hispanic Heritage Month, what is it?
Well, Hispanic Heritage Month actually started out as a day, and then it went into a week, and eventually, I think it was under Ronald Reagan, that it became a month. And it essentially to recognize the contributions that people of Hispanic heritage, and I use Hispanic because that's the census word, and we are particularly referring to people who have a background where Spanish was spoken, to the contributions that they have had to the development of the United States as a nation.
If we're talking about contributions, what specifically are their contributions in Southeast Missouri?
Well, I think if we look at agriculture in particular, our agriculture is, I would say, fairly heavily based in migrant labor and with documented labor as well. So you have the migrant labor and then you have the documented labor. If you look at our restaurants, we have numerous Mexican restaurants here in town. We have many businesses that have Latino ownership. And if you look at the history of our region, I like to point out that it was a Spaniard, Hernando de Soto, that was the first European to step foot in this region whenever he was doing his exploration. And that at one point for about 40 years during the from like 1763 to about 1801, that this territory was under Spanish rule because it was ceded back to Spain. And that's how we get New Madrid. And if you look along the Mississippi River, you'll still see a lot of Spanish names for towns that are left over from that time period.
And that is pretty significant in this region when we're talking about identity and how we identify this region.
Exactly, because typically this aspect has been overlooked because we do have such a vibrant presence. If you look at St. Genevieve,
mm-hmm. French, German,
exactly, Altenburg, and that is very true. So what we did not see from the Spanish of that time period was colonization. So we did not see that. In fact, they were just here as figureheads. Very few people came. But if we look at migration, when we think of the point that the United States, after its formation, that a good chunk of the territory, for example, if we think of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, that we acquired territory that is now part of the United States, that was part of Mexico. And so you have people that were Mexican citizens that once this was acquired, that then became part of a new country. But these are still people that have a different cultural background that were part of this new organization of a country of the United States.
Well, the university, as well as just looking at in the Cape Girardeau area, has some events planned for Hispanic Heritage Month. The first being tacos at Twilight on September 17th. Can you talk about what people can expect from that?
Okay, so one, we're going to say, come have a taco. And two, this is our first time. This is a student-driven event, and I think it should really be recognized that students are working very hard on this. We have the Student Organization of Latinos on campus, and we really wanted to bring to the community. So normally these events only happen on Southeast campus. So this is a student event and it is a Southeast event, but we wanted to do it in the community so that way people could come out and have some food, have some real tacos. We're going to have some piñatas. We're going to have music. Jose Andres Miño, who is a local musician in town, he's going to be playing. We have, I think, Gema de la Rocha is going to be doing some dancing maybe. And I want to mention that Father Paco over at St. Vincent's has been very instrumental in helping us try to secure funding for this. But it really is a sense to build community, to let people know that we have, you know, a couple thousand people just in Cape County that are of Hispanic descent, and to recognize and thank them for the contributions that they have for our community. I would also like to say that if you would like to donate, that would be very much appreciated. The foundation has allowed us to do a crowdfunding. It's for tacos at Twilight. If you go to impact.cmo.edu, then you can make a donation. Or if you just simply Google tacos at Twilight, we are the first thing to come up.
Well, then you guys are also going to be having some speakers as well throughout the month. There will be two on September 22nd, the first being Rudy Guevara, talking about Mexipino, and the second, Anne
Kaniko, talking about Japanese exclusion, both talking about this combination of multi-ethnic identities. Can you talk more about that concept of being multi-ethnic from that perspective?
Of course. These are going to be excellent presentations. What Anne focuses on, and Anne has done research in Peru, so she has brought this into the Japanese Peruvian community. She is going to be the first presenter. It's going to be at 3 in the university ballroom on September 22nd, and she is going to be screening parts of her films. One is A Flicker in Eternity, and the other is Manzanar. And it's this idea that during the internment, the question of somebody's nationality really came to the forefront, and she questions that, but she does it through film. She's a beautiful filmmaker. The one film in particular, The Flicker in Eternity, is about a young gentleman who was Japanese-American who was interned, but he went to fight in the war. He was a great artist. He was killed the day before he's supposed to go home. And so what she does in this film is she takes his drawings and brings to life how he felt to be an interned person, to not be considered part of the U.S. And then Rudy is really the keynote speaker. We're having the Asians in the Americas Symposium here, the 22nd and the 23rd. Rudy is going to be speaking at 5, and it's also going to be in the university ballroom. And what he brings to light is this idea that you can be Mexicano. So not only as you think of ethnically that your parents got together and it was someone Mexican, someone was Filipino, but also in the cultural relations between the two groups. And so he brings to the forefront some of the conversations about what it means to have cultures live side by side or together in the same space and some of the dynamics that come out of that relationship.
What are some of those dynamics?
So I think one of the most interesting points I heard from him and is this idea, for example, if we think of the United Farm Worker movement, that it was by Cesar Chavez, and it does not take anything from what Cesar Chavez did, but really the United Farm Worker movement was started by the Filipino community because they were migrant workers as well, or they were working in the farm community. And then Cesar Chavez came and he became the figure, but really it was a co-effort between the Filipino workers and between the Mexican-American workers. And so I think that's what he brings to the conversation is this idea that we may have an understanding of something, but if we really look into what really happened, as we were discussing earlier about facts, then you see that it's a much more complex situation than what we originally thought it was going to be. And we can learn from that.
Well, going off of that, there's going to be another speaker on October 3rd, and that'll be Jorge Rio Pedre talking about Casa de Salud. What can people expect from his conversation?
His conversation is absolutely amazing. Most of people have not heard of La Casa de Salud. It is an immigrant health clinic in St. Louis. It will take in anybody who wants to go, but it's been primarily Latino. And he is going to talk about their model. It's based on St. Louis University's campus, and their idea is that every human deserves health care. And immigrants are some of the first to fall through the cracks because they have no legal. Some of them may not have a legal status. They don't ask about that. They just want to make certain that the person is taken care of. So it's kind of to go back to the patient centered rather than worry about all that other stuff. How can we help the patient? And we actually hear Dr. Linda Garner, Dr. Doc Billingsley, and Dr. Brooke Clubs. We received an FFR grant here on campus, and we're actually taking students to the Casa de Salud right before Jorge comes to visit because we want them to see this model and to understand how language and culture are very important in providing effective, efficient, and caring health care.
And then people will get a chance to hear from Alexis Engelhart, and her discussion will focus on Spanish and medical brigades on September 27th. What does that conversation entail? Because that sounds really interesting. Medical brigades.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to add one thing because I forgot to say Jorge's date. He's going to be here on October 3rd at 3 in Glenn Auditorium. Now to Alexis. Alexis is a wonderful student. So here at Southeast last summer, I went to Mexico because we decided we were going to start teaching classes for the health professions in Spanish. Spanish for the health professions, I should say. And so I did some training in Mexico, and then started teaching them. Alexis was in the first cohort. I still have about 5, I would say 7 students from the original cohorts that have started in 1 or started in 2, and now they're in my Spanish 3 for the health professions. And Alexis, I was just talking with this about her. She's going to talk about how she changed as a person because she did the medical brigades. And it was her first time, I think, she went to Honduras. And it really opened her eyes to problems, but also to the idea that maybe I do need to learn another language. Maybe it would be good for me to learn how to come closer to somebody else to help them rather than just assume that that they will come to me, that they will change so that I can help them. And it was, she said it was just a very powerful movement. And to the point, she's the first one in the cohort that is going to go abroad completely in Spanish. And if we can get everything done in time, she's going to end up with a double major in Spanish, focusing on healthcare and with her, I think she's, I don't want to mispronounce what she's doing. She's not doing pre-physicians, but let's just say with her pre-med degree, because she may be changing exactly what she's going to study. So, and it's a student. And I think that's what makes it impactful, because she's just got pictures. She's going to talk about how she changed as a person through this. So she is going to be, as you said, September 27th in Sadie's Place. It's an Athenaeum series presentation at noon.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Marissa, and I appreciate it.
That was Debbie Lee DiStefano, a professor of Spanish in the Department of Modern Languages, Anthropology, and Geography at Southeast Missouri State University. More on Going Public here on KRCU after the break.
Hi, I'm Ari Shapiro. Love what you hear on your car radio, but don't love your car anymore? Well, donate it to us. Your car can be turned into the programs you love. Here's how.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. 10 personnel from the Cape Girardeau Fire Department's Regional HSRT Technical Rescue Team and the Jackson Fire and Rescue were deployed to areas experiencing the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. Alongside several other Missouri fire districts, they helped in rescue operations, searching 450 homes surrounded by floodwater. KRCU's Lindsay Grogene spoke with Assistant Chief Mark Hashider of the Cape Girardeau Fire Department about their experience in the Texas Gulf Coast and if they'll be needed during the aftermath of Hurricane Irma.
You and a group of 9 other local volunteers went down to Texas Gulf Coast last week. Tell me about that experience.
Well, this has been our first deployment out of state. The city of Cape Girardeau does have a technical rescue team, which does also have an arm of swiftwater rescue technicians, as well as in the boats. We have responded in past floods into our area in southeast Missouri, but this was the first time that we were tasked with going to an out-of-state incident. So in that regard, it had a lot of educational experiences. As well, we were able to provide a lot of our knowledge and use that knowledge down in Houston to help a lot of people in need.
You all, along with other Missouri teams, helped out in saving 19 people and 2 animals. Tell me about those experiences.
Well, basically, a lot of those had stayed in their homes and were trying to wait out the situation that they were in. And as the days progress, it gets a little tougher without electricity and being able to stay in your home with water surrounding it and not able to get out. A lot of the primary searches had been completed by Houston as well as other assets that they had in the area. So we were doing secondary searches, going to each house, making sure that the house had been evacuated, if there were residents inside the house, to make sure that they were accounted for, and if they would like to leave that area. And then we brought them out and were put into, sometimes referred to down there as a lily pad, a dry area, then they could be taken to either a reception and carrier, or they were simply met with relatives, friends that then would take them to another house.
In Missouri, we don't get tropical weather like this. How do you all train your technicians and operators to save people in a hurricane environment?
Well, you know, yes, it was a hurricane environment. We were there, though, it was a flood environment. We are very, very used to those flood environments with people. Our latest incident prior to going to Texas was down in Donovan. So we had, you know, swift water. We had houses that were surrounded by water. So we had all the same type of hazards that we were dealing with, other than some of the animals, critters. Some of the guys were a little concerned about the alligators, but we had no problems with those. But it's basically the same, other than the scope of the operational area was extremely large. Houston is being, what, the 4th largest city, I think, in the United States. You know, we were given some subdivisions in which we then operated with other rescue agencies.
So what did disaster zones look like? If you weren't in the hurricane's wind damage zone, what was the flood damage like?
Yeah, the wind damage area, that was more to the south of where we were at. But as far as the damages of the home, you know, as we progressed into the areas that had started to dry out a little bit, furniture was being stacked up in the front. And then as we got further into the area that was still flooded, you know, you had homes that had waters all the way up to their eaves, to their doors. There was numerous cars, which, you know, led us to believe that the area that we were operating in flooded very quickly. That prevented them from actually, you know, even leaving the area. The last area that we worked in was where the two largest reservoirs that they've been talking about. We were probably operating within a mile of each reservoir, probably 600 yards where the both of those would drain together, the confluence of those two reservoirs.
All right. So what are some of the risks that come along with going down to a disaster zone like the Texas Gulf Coast after Hurricane Harvey?
Well, the one that causes us the most concern will be obstacles within the water that we cannot see that can damage our boats. Number two would be the current. We're always very, very concerned about swift water current. And then you throw in, for instance, if the electricity is still on in the building, you can still have some problems associated with electric with the homes. So the obstacles, the current and electricity, and then just simply trying to manage people to get in and out of your boat safely is also a concern.
Did you all go down on a volunteer basis, or was that a government organization involved in contacting you?
There are mutual aid PACs within the states. So what does occur, the state of Texas will reach out to other states and request different needs. In this particular instance, they wanted over 100 Type 1 rescue teams. Missouri looked at it and said, we can help out with that. They then send out that need to various departments and say, can you assist with this? And we look at it and say, yes, we have the type of resources that they want, the type of training that they need, and we provide that to the state of Missouri. State of Missouri then provides it to Texas. And I'll say right now is that the state of Missouri is already getting requests for our overhead command teams for Hurricane Irma, and they are trying to fulfill those. And I think we've had just a few people from the state of Missouri already being deployed or en route down to staging areas for Irma.
So September is National Preparedness Month. As timely as this is that you guys are coming back from Hurricane Harvey, what kind of tips do you have for families who live in the area to be prepared?
Self-preparedness is the most important item. No matter how many different assets for fire departments you have, it's going to be very, very difficult to be able to help every single individual in their time of need. So to be able to prepare themselves as much as possible, and we talk about the food, the water, the medication for 72 hours to up to 5 days, it would be sufficient to allow the outside resources to come in and assist. And I think it's critical that people have those first initial days of self-support. And I think the other one is just simply is the recognition of potential incidents that could affect them, whether it be snowstorms here in the Midwest, the flooding. You know, they do need to be prepared. It's very unexpected. A lot of the people down in Texas were completely cut off guard about the flooding situation.
All right. Is there anything else that you wanted to point out about the rescue team and kind of their efforts in helping out kind of our fellow Americans?
Well, I think there's a couple things that I really noticed quite a bit is, you know, our willingness, of course, of our firefighters from Cape Girardeau, Jackson, Kansas City, Central Jackson are very, very eager to help people to drive the 15 hours and willingness to really to go to work right away. And then what's really kind of nice is that the people that are involved and sometimes in the disaster is to turn around and try to help us. For example, you know, we had people coming up to us. I had a little girl, probably 4 years old, that had helped her mother make some cupcakes for us. So they're almost involved in the incident, and we're here to help those people in distress. And there's other people in that area that are helping us. So it's very deeply moving in which you can see people helping people. It's a team of firefighters, but it is our city, our citizens that support our ability to be able to provide that resource. We feel that if we were hit with a magnitude of earthquake to describe, is that we will be reaching out to other communities in other states. So it is definitely a situation that helps all communities in our area in the nation.
Thank you so much, Chief Hashatter.
Thank you.
That was KRCU's Lindsay Grojean speaking with Assistant Chief Mark Hashider of the Cape Girardeau Fire Department about their deployment to the Texas Gulf Coast. All team members arrived home safely on Tuesday. That's our show. To hear the stories from today, visit krcu.org or go to iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 for KRCU's Going Public.